The lines have never been clearer. Gaza will write its name in blood, not tears. When the chance came at the United Nations to call for a ceasefire, as suggested by Russia, only four nations voted against it, effectively blocking the motions. Those nations were the United States, Britain, France, and Japan. The day after that motion was voted against, Israel bombed the Baptist hospital in Gaza, killing up to 1,000 people. Many were displaced and sheltering there. Many others were patients, and many were children. Israel had bombed the hospital 4 days earlier, injuring doctors who were struggling to save lives. The following three consecutive days, Israel warned the hospital that it must evacuate because Israel would bomb it. In the aftermath, Israeli digital spokesman Hanania Naftali was jubilant about the strike. However, he quickly withdrew back the tweet, and Israel pushed its propaganda infrastructure with the notion that the bomb had not come from the Israeli air forces. Lies upon lies ensued, all aimed at weakening people's support for Palestinian resistance forces. Sleep not, Israel. The world has seen your face.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm pleased to welcome back Richard Medhurst once again as our guest today, and he joins us via Skype. Richard is an independent investigative journalist focusing on US politics, international relations, the Middle East, and Julian Assange's fight against extradition to the United States for exposing US war crimes in Iraq. Richard's built up a large following on his YouTube channel, and his work has also been published on numerous international news outlets, including the Black Agenda Report, Press TV, Al Mayadeen, and The Canary. Welcome to the show. David, Israel's bombed hospitals, schools, mosques, a church, residential buildings. I mean, what does this say about Israel's strategy here?
Well, we can see straight away, can't we, that this is not what Israel says it's doing. It says it's trying to defeat Hamas. And, of course, what it's trying to do is to bomb Gaza into the Stone Age and indeed to try and kill so many people that there's no viable population left there and to force the rest of them out into Sinai. They want them to leave into Sinai so that they can reoccupy the Gaza Strip and never allow the Palestinians back in again. So this would be refugees who had been expelled into Gaza and now they're trying to expel them again. So this is the objective. This is the second Nakba, the killing or expulsion of the Palestinians. It's nothing to do with attempting to target Hamas. Of course, they haven't done that yet because, one, they're frightened of doing it because they will lose so many soldiers, and two, because the Americans are not convinced that the IDF, the so-called IDF, is capable of launching a ground offensive. So that's what they're doing. They're deciding instead to take revenge on the ordinary people of Gaza.
Well, Richard, I wonder whether you might just say a word or two about Britain's role in this.
Well, yesterday there was a vote in the UN Security Council about whether, you know, they could come to an agreement, they could agree on a resolution to call on a ceasefire, just a simple ceasefire. And of course, you know, our representative at the UN in New York decided to support the US resolution while vetoing everything that the Russians had proposed. Now, there was no difference between the US text and the Russian text. The only tiny speck of difference was that the Russian text did not explicitly call for underscoring Israel's right to self-defense, which is, of course, a phrase that is always used to kind of, to silence the Palestinians' right to self-defense and uphold what Israel is doing in Palestine, which is, to call that self-defense, you know, bombing hospitals and churches and mosques is lunacy. So, you know, I find this really telling that usually Israel, of course, goes into Gaza and they bomb it, they kill thousands of people, and the world looks the other way. But usually in the other conflicts, we made the pretense of at least calling for a ceasefire. This time, we're not even bothering to do that. We're just, publicly saying that, yeah, everything Israel is doing, its behavior is fine, and it should continue doing that. And at the same time, on the home front, so not just on the international stage, but on the home front, people in the UK are being propagandized like you would not believe. I mean, I was just watching Sky News now, and they were questioning the death figures, you know, like, so they obviously, they can't come on and justify killing 2,000 children, because that doesn't work to call them Hamas fighters, right? So they just start saying, well, the figures aren't correct because the Gaza Health Ministry is run by Hamas. Yes, well, Hamas are the government there, but Hamas cannot just fake numbers. So, you know, this is the level of propaganda that people in the UK are being subjected to. But it is good, and it is good to underscore the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets. Yeah. So it seems like the propaganda is not working. It might work, you know, with our ambassador at the UN in New York, but it's not going to work and stop people from coming out in their hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, what's the significance of the US Delta Force here? Because we know they were key, weren't they, in the assassination of Qasem Soleimani?
That's right, and they seem to be directly involved in Gaza. They seem to be involved in this alleged plan to flood the tunnels, the Hamas tunnels, with nerve agent, which is a truly extraordinary, thing which they seem to be planning. But they were also involved in the incursion. There have been small incursions into Gaza by the Israeli offence forces, and Delta Force seem to have been involved in that. And there seems to be, in particular, an ambush by resistance fighters, and many of the soldiers who were involved, possibly the US Delta Force, were actually caught in that ambush, seriously wounded, and had to withdraw. So there's an indication here that the American soldiers are directly involved in confronting the resistance. Now, that isn't going to go well for them if it kicks off fully.
No, indeed. Well, Richard, I know that you've spoken out about Israel's targeting of Christians before, haven't you? But what do you think this latest episode in Gaza tells us about it?
Well, this term, Christian Zionist, always confused me. And as we know, in the United States, among evangelicals, or some evangelicals, they've always used support for Israel as a means to whip up votes. Right. So this is a voter base that one must cater to if running for president or other houses in offices in the United States. So, you know, the fact that Israel bombed the oldest church in Gaza, I mean, this thing has been there since the 5th century. It survived every crusade. It survived 1,600 years of various occupations and invasions, but it couldn't survive Israel. And these so-called, you know, Christian Zionists in America had nothing to say about it. They had nothing to say about Israel destroying this church, and not only the building, more importantly, killing worshippers that were inside. Some of those worshippers that were killed are actually related to someone who's in the U.S. Congress. I'm certain he cannot speak out because he'll probably lose his job. But I think this is so telling, and I'm still, I find this bewildering. What exactly is Christian, you know, quote unquote, about anything that Israel does? I mean, they think that if they look at the Bible and they, you know, start reading the Old Testament, that they can find reasons to justify the Zionist state. These two things have nothing to do with each other. And you know, if we look at the Ten Commandments, one of the most important ones is "Thou shalt not kill." I wish the Israelis and the Zionist Christians and the United States would actually apply that part instead of just cherry-picking the ones that they like.
Because absolutely.
Everything that Israel does, Israel's behavior has nothing to do with Judaism, Islam, or Christianity. No. And all of these religions come from Palestine.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, and Richard was just saying there, you know, he found it bewildering. But, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has spoken out in support of Israel, hasn't he? And he's also a president, isn't he, of the Council for Christians and Jews. I mean, what do you know about that organisation?
Well, the Council for Christians and Jews is a Zionist organisation set up by a key Zionist ideologue, Sir Sigmund Sternberg, who died in 2016. And it's there to propagandise the Zionist message within Christian community, and indeed the Muslim community. They brought in a Muslim as one of the alleged co-founders, but it was run by Sternberg. And he also runs a number of other groups, including one we've talked about on this program before, the Forum for Discussion of Israel and Palestine, which during the last Gaza confrontation was sending people into schools to lie to school children about what was happening in Gaza and to pretend that there were both sides here, there was a conflict, this wasn't just an occupation and a colonial occupation at that. So this is a long-term Zionist lobby group. We should remember that the Zionists have been trying to infiltrate the whole range of groups in the society in order that when these things come around, there is no one to speak out for the people indeed. Who are being oppressed.
No, indeed, as we've reported on this show on numerous occasions, haven't we? But we're just going to have to pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got an expose now on Hananya Naftali, who's an influential Zionist social media influencer who also worked as a social media advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu.
Hananya Naftali was one of the first to claim the hospital bombing in Gaza for the occupation forces. On October 17, he posted on X that they struck a Hamas terrorist base inside a hospital. Shortly after, he deleted the post. "I mistakenly shared this information. I apologize for this error, as the IDF does not bomb hospitals." Hananya likes to mislead on his origins. Here he is on the 15th of October, falsely claiming to have been born and raised in Israel. He has been making this claim for years, such as here, back in 2014, where he claims to be a native-born Israeli Jew. In fact, he is the child of Russian settler colonists. Born in Safed, he grew up in what the Zionists call Samaria, an illegal settlement on Palestinian land, not in Israel. Naftali also likes to pretend he's a civilian, a social media influencer. He describes himself as a media personality. "I'm that Israeli who talks to the camera about peace in the Middle East," he says. In the past, Hananya and his wife, India, who is an American settler colonist, shot a video together in their personal bomb shelter on the 7th of October, which reportedly went viral on social media. In it, he claimed simply to be a civilian, but his backstory indicates that this is a lie.
"These explosions are rockets that were meant to hit us, civilians."
In fact, Naftali helped terrorize Palestinians in the occupation forces during 2014's Operation Protective Edge. He was also involved in the regime operation to patch up fighters, including from Nusra, the Syrian affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and send them back to the regime change operation targeting the Syrian government. He remained in the reserves ever since. Netanyahu hired him in 2018 as a social media advisor. And when he married his wife, India, Netanyahu himself gave a speech. When he posted his tweet on the hospital bombing on the 17th, he was still claiming to be a civilian. But it is clear from other social media posts that he had said, October the 9th on X, that he was recently called up to fight. He said in an October the 14th video that he had already been called by Netanyahu to join a task force to defend Israel in the media. Perhaps his worst intervention was also hastily removed from the internet, but not before it was screen-grabbed and posted online. On his Farsi language X account, he posted a photo of dead Palestinian children with the message, "The world should thank us for destroying these little time bombs. In fact, we're preventing similar events from happening to other nations in the coming years." The idea of children as time bombs is not an aberration of Naftali's thinking. It is deeply ingrained in Zionist propaganda, as can be seen in this image of a propaganda war room on the campus of the interdisciplinary Center Israel's only private university from back in 2009. The war room was created by Stand With Us, a group created with the help from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The poster in the background asks if the child in the picture will grow up to be a doctor, a teacher, or a terrorist. Of course, whichever it is, they will be targeted by the Zionist occupation forces.
David, this Naftali character presents himself as a journalist and a social media influencer, doesn't he? But isn't the truth that he's actually a paid propagandist for the Zionist entity?
Well, yes, he's a paid propagandist, but he's also, of course, in the Israel occupation forces directly and was involved in a tank regiment terrorising Gaza, was involved in sending Nusra back into the fight against President Assad of Syria, and here he is in his uniform. You know, at the same time as he's still presenting himself on his ex or formerly Twitter account as being a social media influencer who's a civilian. I mean, these are lies. And, of course, it's a strategic lie which the Israelis try and tell all the time, which is that people who are being killed in the conflict are civilians. Well, as we see in this example and in many, many other examples, these people are either directly in the occupation forces or are reservists in the occupation forces. And, of course, let's remember, they're a settler militia which bear arms. Of course, Palestinians aren't allowed to bear arms, but the settlers are allowed to bear arms, and they're, of course, protected also by the armed Israel occupation forces. So this is a key element of the propaganda to suggest that the people in Israel, as it's called, are civilians and they're just being targeted by terrorists. But actually, look, this is a highly militarised society.
Of course. Well, Richard, what's your assessment of what happened in the hospital bombing, and what do you think it says about the Zionist strategy in Gaza?
Well, if I could just add a short comment about the propagandist we were looking at. You know, he's clearly dressed up in the uniform of the Israeli occupation forces. If this were the spokesperson or someone doing any form of what he's doing for, let's say, Hamas or for the Syrian government or for Iran or for Hezbollah, the Israelis would not hesitate to kill that person and then tell the whole world that this person was a terrorist spokesperson. So I think the double standard there is blistering. Now, about the hospital, this is truly one of the most egregious, if not the most egregious, offenses the Israelis have committed in this entire conflict since Al-Aqsa flood began on October 7th. I mean, how do you bomb a hospital and get away with that? How do you kill 500 people? You extinguish the lives of 500 people in one fell swoop and get away with this? This is bewildering. And it's like, you know, an orchestra, a symphony of news organizations rushing to regurgitate what the Israeli foreign ministry are saying, that, you know, this was a Hamas rocket. Where's the proof? The Israelis released some shady, blurry video that does not prove a thing. And we all know the only people that have the ordnances, the payloads, the bombs capable of destroying a hospital like that are none other than the Israelis. This was not, you know, Angola's Air Force bombing Gaza. It wasn't China. It wasn't Brazil. It was the Israelis. And they were doing it with our munitions and munitions from the Americans. And that is a stain upon all of us.
Yes, absolutely. Well, David, I mean, this repugnant idea that somehow babies are time bombs, I mean, that's not a new theme, is it, in Zionist propaganda?
It's not new, and it goes right across the whole range of different Zionist organisations. So the example we saw there was with Stand With Us, where they had these war rooms they pioneered in the Interdisciplinary Centre in Herzliya, in 2009, 10, 11, which was run with the Interdisciplinary Centre, which, of course, reserves places for Israeli elite forces and for intelligence operations. And Stand With Us, of course, was set up with help from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But it's also the kind of idea you get in some of the religious settlers, including the Hilltop Youth, one of the key yeshivas there, with the rabbis there who wrote this thing called the King's Torah. We've talked about this in the show before, where they talk about how it's permissible to kill Palestinian babies because they might grow up to threaten us one day. Exact replica of the time bomb, or the question you've got to ask there, is this going to grow up to be a terrorist or a doctor or a teacher? And of course, actually, doesn't make any difference what they're going to grow up to, because the Israelis will kill them all, and that's the key thing.
That's the tragic thing, yeah. Well, Richard, I mean, you've had your YouTube channel demonetized over the hospital bombing, haven't you? I mean, just tell us about that, will you?
Well, this is part of a larger trend to just silence anyone who's critical of Israel. Professor David Miller can attest to that because he was targeted by the Zionist lobby. My channel, this is the second time that they've targeted my journalism. The first time was in 2020. That's when I was first demonetized. And, you know, lo and behold, what was I doing during this period? It was during the Abraham Accords, and I was criticizing the Abraham Accords and Israel's attempt to try and grab more territory from the West Bank. And so now they've demonetized my channel without really telling me why. You know, I still don't even know what, you know, what I said that is wrong. Did I make a factual error? You know, I don't know. I've been trying now for years actually to avoid showing anything gory on purpose. So you know, I don't afford them the possibility to do something like this. And even that is actually bizarre because, you know, it's not that like we're interested in showing people these horrific scenes from Gaza, but we must show them so people know the truth. You know, I don't understand why it's okay for Israel to butcher people, but we can't tell people about the butchering. We can't show it to them, you know, lest we be punished by the algorithm or by, you know, through censorship. And now, once again, I, you know, the whole time I tried my best to, you know, phrase things very clearly, you know, spelling out Hamas's right to resist through the Geneva Convention and the UN Charter. But I still don't know why. The only thing I do know is that I was covering Israel's crimes in Gaza, and now they took away my primary source of income. So there's European press freedom for you.
Oh, indeed, indeed, indeed. But David, I mean, I wonder whether you might just sort of give us a view on whether this assault on Gaza is actually wiping out Hamas.
Well, the thing we always need to remember whenever you are asked the question about Hamas is, do you mean Hamas? Do they mean Hamas? Mm. Or do they mean the PFLP? Or do they mean the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine? Or the Palestinian Islamic Jihad? Or indeed the armed wing of Fatah? Now, who do they mean that they're trying to wipe out? Is it the whole of the Palestinian resistance? Mm. Well, that's kind of what they're saying. Mm. But is it actually doing that? No, of course, it's targeting civilians, punishing children, and that's what they're actually doing. But have they significantly degraded the capability of the Palestinian resistance? No, they haven't. Mm. And they remain there, ready, and they're still firing rockets and missiles from Gaza. But let's also remember that the existential issue that they face is if they go in there, they go in the ground in Gaza, they will lose thousands and thousands and thousands of their soldiers. Mm. And, of course, the difficulty is that they've got a second front on the northern border where Hezbollah have taken out significant numbers of tanks and almost all of the surveillance equipment which is on the border there. And that, of course, is a much more significant military threat to them. Yeah. Hamas, the PFLP, the DFLP and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are a very significant military threat to them. But Hezbollah is even more of a threat to them and they can't fight on both fronts at the same time.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So let me thank our guest, Richard Medhurst, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the fog of war descending once more as the Zionist regime's propaganda machine lurches into motion, fabricating myths to shield the truth following the bombing of Gaza hospitals, and Western leaders and media obediently amplify Israel's distortions, muddying reality, we take a look at the world press and media's coverage of this story. Stay tuned now for the second part of this two-part program. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. Doctors in northern Gaza Strip are sounding the alarm about a humanitarian catastrophe as the Israeli regime continues its ferocious airstrikes and siege on the coastal enclave for a third week. Since the Israeli regime cut off all electricity, fuel and water to Gaza on 9th of October, hospitals have been overwhelmed in Gaza with a lack of life-saving resources and a high volume of critically wounded patients. Patients who have been wounded in airstrikes, pregnant women, children and people with kidney failure are some of the worst affected. The hospitals that are still working are running on generators, which health officials say won't last for long. Gaza's biggest hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital, doctors are facing with a massive influx of casualties, adding that thousands of displaced civilians are taking shelter in the hospital. Basel Amr, a volunteer at intensive care unit physician at the Shifa Hospital, highlighted the number of the wounded brought in at once. He said this is bigger than the hospital's capacity. This applies to the space in both the urgent care and the operation rooms. Basel Amr, a volunteer at the intensive care unit, a physician, said, "We have 17 operation rooms that are prepared at the same time during massacres and ready to be used, but that is not enough. Most of the wounded need operations. But we only have the capacity to deal with 17 people at a time, while the rest wait for their turn, and some die in front of our eyes, and we cannot help them in any way because the operation rooms are full. The wounded keep dying in front of our eyes, but there's nothing that we can do." The most traumatizing situation faced by Basel Amr and his colleagues is the fact that they have to prioritize some cases over others. "We are left in a situation where we have to make the difficult decision to risk the life of one patient in order to save the life of another patient." Basel Amr, a volunteer ICU physician, also pointed out that the hospital has no space for post-operative care and many patients have to sleep in the intensive care units, which he says hinders the work of intensive care doctors. This forces doctors to treat patients on the floor of the hospital. "The hospital won't be able to deal with any other crisis in the coming days, as its equipment and necessary tools are already running out," he warned. On Wednesday, 25th of October, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said that at least 12 out of the 35 hospitals in Gaza are now out of service because of damage from Israeli bombardment and Israel's decision to cut off fuel and electricity supplies to the besieged enclave. The United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that 46 out of 72 healthcare clinics have also been shut down in Gaza, leaving thousands of people without any form of medical aid amid the ongoing heavy bombardment. The remaining clinics and hospitals are running on generators and have few resources to treat patients who have been critically wounded or are in intensive care. Doctors and health officials have been warning for days that fuel is set to run out soon and completely by next Thursday. They say this will lead to the instant death of thousands of people in Gaza, including newborn babies in incubators, wounded people in intensive care units, and kidney dialysis patients, among others. As Israel prepares for its planned ground invasion of Gaza, it has warned residents of northern Gaza to flee south to avoid being targeted. That includes hospitals. But health officials at Gaza's biggest hospitals have insisted the evacuation of the wounded and displaced people is impossible. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip are also dangerously overcrowded, as almost 1.4 million people in Gaza are now internally displaced. Thousands have taken shelter in hospitals. The Al-Shifa Hospital alone is now home to 62,000 displaced people, according to Amr. And viruses are spreading rapidly. This compounds the lack of sterilization at the hospital for patients, which makes them vulnerable to infections. International organizations have warned about the spread of waterborne diseases in Gaza and scabies because of a lack of clean water in the territory. Amr added, the type of wounds received by this hospital, mainly scarring and disfigurations, indicates another health crisis after the end of hostilities. Amr added, many of the wounded will live but will have to be on medication for a long time to manage their pain, which may lead to addiction. Others will live with disabilities for the rest of their lives. Hossam Al-Madhoun, another doctor at the hospital, highlighted a similar situation at Al-Oda Hospital in northern Gaza. He said the Oda Hospital has no space to walk, as thousands of civilians have also taken refuge there from Israeli bombings. Similar to Al-Shifa Hospital, Al-Oda Hospital doesn't have enough room for casualties and is suffering a severe shortage of supplies. In the beginning, there was a scarcity of medical supplies. Now there is a scarcity of available beds at the intensive care unit and of oxygen, medical and sterilization materials, he told the Middle East Eye. I referred a girl with a nerve injury to the neurosurgery department, but was told there was no capacity to take her. Dr. Hossam Al-Madhoun added, Gaza is now suffering from a shortage of shrouds. There is nothing worse than not finding enough shrouds to cover the martyrs, to cover the dead, so you wrap them with garbage bags and old pieces of cloth. Hossam Al-Madhoun, however, is undeterred. He said, I'm physically and emotionally exhausted, but this is my duty and I must carry on.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth. Date February 11, 1983. The Islamic Consultative Assembly that is at the head of all bodies at the same time that it has knowledgeable, intellectual and educated individuals. It would be good if, wherever necessary, it invites devoted experts in the commissions so that with meeting of their minds, the tasks are performed quickly and assuredly. The opinion of devoted and pious experts is to be taken for identifying the subjects for the secondary tenets of Islam so that the tasks are performed in a befitting manner.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain sentences and speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the subject of Palestine, which is a quite controversial issue nowadays, and in the recent days, in fact, this great character has said, "Because of my religious obligation, I hereby warn the people of Iran and the Muslims of the world that the Holy Quran and Islam are in danger. The independence of our country and its economy are in danger of being seized by the Zionists. With the deadly silence of the Muslims, it won't be long before the Zionists destroy the existence of the Muslim nation in all its aspects." Well, the Palestinian issue and the malicious behavior of Israel were always topics that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh talked about in his speeches, because it was of great importance to him. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi. The Holy Imam rahmatullah alayh conceded the increasing power of Israel and the subjugation of Muslim nations at the hands of this brutal regime to be the destruction of Islam and the Holy Book of Quran. When the Third Arab-Israeli War broke out in 1973, Imam rahmatullah alayhi delivered a message to the Islamic governments and Muslim nations stressing the need to maintain unity. He called upon them to gather all their forces in order to fight Israel. In this speech, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh summarized the mechanisms involved in the fight against Israel in several categories, and he announced these to the general Muslim population. As a matter of fact, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh emphasized maintaining unity for the liberation of Palestine as being the most important main path to achieving victory. This was because he didn't believe that the large colonial powers' intention for creating Israel was merely to occupy Palestine. Imam rahmatullah alayh, in fact, believed that if the way was open to Israel, all Muslim countries would eventually end up suffering the same fate as Palestine. That is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh likened Israel to cancerous tumor, and he said that its immediate eradication was obligatory for all Muslims. Thank you very much. Until another episode, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Multiple capitals and cities across the globe have witnessed massive demonstrations and marches these days in solidarity with the Palestinian people amid the ongoing Zionist regime's genocidal aggression on the Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, in Yemen's Sana'a, protesters denounced the Zionist regime's genocidal war against Palestinians. Syrians also gathered in a Jaramna camp to voice their support for Palestinians. Lebanese Hezbollah supporters took to the streets for the same reason, and Palestinians in the occupied West Bank also rallied in solidarity of the people of Gaza. Similar rallies were held in several other countries, including Turkey, Jordan, and Pakistan, as well as many other parts of the world where thousands of people marched to condemn the Zionist regime's brutality. According to Wafa News Agency, in London, the UK, over 100,000 people took to the streets in a show of solidarity with the Palestinian people and in protest of the ongoing Israeli regime aggression on Gaza. The crowds assembled near the Golden Jubilee Bridge in the heart of London and concluded at Parliament Square. Demonstrators waved banners reading "Gaza, stop the massacre," and "Free Palestine, end the occupation." Thousands also participated in protests condemning the Israeli regime aggression against the Palestinian people in various cities across the UK, including Manchester and Glasgow. Protesters displayed Palestinian flags and banners with slogans such as "Freedom for Palestine," "End the massacre," and "Sanctions on Israel." In Istanbul, Turkey, thousands of people rallied in solidarity with the Palestinian people, demanding an immediate halt to the ongoing Israeli regime aggression on Gaza. Most Turkish provinces also already witnessed protests against the massacres committed by Israeli regime occupation forces against the Palestinian people. In the French capital Paris, thousands participated in a rally to express their support for the Palestinian people. Demonstrators chanted slogans such as "Gaza, Gaza, Paris is with you," and "It is humanity that is being killed, Gaza's children, Palestine's children." Several lawmakers also joined the protest, wearing keffiyehs and carrying Palestinian flags. Similar protests were held in several cities across Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, condemning the ongoing aggression and massacres that have resulted in over 7,000 innocent Palestinian casualties, primarily among children and women. Demonstrators called for an immediate halt to the Zionist regime's aggression on Gaza, decrying the Israeli atrocities and expressing their discontent with international indifference. Hundreds protested outside the Israeli regime embassy in Canada. In Canada, hundreds gathered outside the Israeli embassy in Toronto, protesting against the massacres of civilians in Gaza. Demonstrators carried Palestinian flags and displayed various slogans, including "Freedom for Palestine." Numerous U.S. states have also seen a series of protests in the past few days, including New York, where thousands of demonstrators called for an end to the Zionist regime's aggression in Gaza and criticized U.S. support for this aggression. The Malaysian capital Kuala Lumpur hosted massive protests, with thousands of people expressing their condemnation of Israeli regime and its crimes. The city has been witnessing a series of continuous protests since the start of the Zionist regime's aggression on Gaza,
with broad participation from various segments of society, organizations, and associations. In the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, thousands of people rallied in support of Palestine and in condemnation of the Zionist regime's aggression against Gaza. Demonstrators also criticized international silence regarding these events. Demonstrations took place in various European countries, with London witnessing the largest turnout, in addition to Brussels, Berlin, Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. In all these countries, participants raised Palestinian flags and chanted the slogans demanding freedom for Palestine, an immediate cessation of the Israeli regime aggression, and an end to the Gaza blockade, and an end to the international support and inaction concerning Zionist regime occupation crimes.
Economic divide.
If there was ever a cause that united people around the world, the Palestinian cause has just done that. Israel's war on Gaza has opened the eyes of the world to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians, and of course, the U.S. all-out support. And now it's time that the world realizes how Israel has strangled the Palestinian economy on a daily basis, including that of Gaza. This is while its own economy is now tanking. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tafwe. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program: the Israeli occupation. Gaza and West Bank economies are controlled, water, electricity, natural resources, including in that, and that's prevented Palestinian economic advancements. Next, we take a look at Israeli control, another one of the highlights, which is large in scope. The Gaza siege, 17 years. You have the occupied Palestinian territories, where imports, workforce participation, and Palestinian products are restricted in more ways than one. We will be taking a look at that. Then Israel's siege. Iran has called at the OIC meeting a call for sanctioning Israel. That points somewhat to a BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, in terms of a reboot. And is there an international will to boycott Israel? As the crisis continues across the occupied Palestinian territories, their concerns are further economic crisis in the occupied West Bank. Since the Israeli military occupied the West Bank, it has deployed a matrix of policies and practices that seeks to control the people of the occupied Palestinian territory. Israeli policies and practices have fragmented the territorial and economic landscape of the West Bank. Its tactics have eroded the productive capacity of the occupied Palestinian territory, depriving it from its growth potential. The occupied Palestinian territories continue to be chronically dependent on donor funding for its fiscal survival. The Palestinian economy remains extremely fragile, structurally weak, and highly dependent on Israel for trade, wage employment, and the provision of basic infrastructure. Reflect an economy that has already lost its viability and fiscal sustainability. The Israeli regime controls the borders, airspace, population registry, and economic activity of the Palestinian territories. Israeli military orders, assigns quotas, and a permit system which restricts a Palestinian access to and the development of water resources. Given the continued and ever-evolving restrictive context,
Palestinian policymakers are left with limited choices as to ways in which to slow down the ongoing deterioration of socioeconomic conditions.
We've lived in the Jordan Valley in the Humsa area for decades. Livestock is our livelihood. Before the announcement of the deal, the occupation used to demolish homes, cut off the water, burn land. The occupation army used to chase us. We suffer a lot from the occupation, especially during their military training.
Time now to take a look at some of the online posts. We try to bring in all sides of the story into this, namely Israel's economy on occupied land, and then the Palestinian economy in the occupied territories, and of course the economy of Gaza. All right, first up, we saw this particular entry on a number of sites, including Twitter, known as X now. Israeli political crisis could cut 2.8% a year from the GDP based on a warning by the central bank. Looking deeper into it, where we went into the website, it said that exports, consumption, and investment could be hit if the row over judicial reforms are not as resolved. Added, the judicial changes would affect Israel's risk premium, exports, consumption, and investment. And then finally, the hit to GDP would be anywhere between 0.8% and 2.8% per year on average for the next 3 years. Ouch, that's got to hurt. Next, Palestine. What challenges does the Palestinian economy face? This entry said, given the sharp decline in aid, which fell from 27% of GDP in 2008 to 1.8% in 2021, the Palestinian Authority has accumulated a large arrear to the private sector, the pension fund, and domestic borrowing. Underlining that part about how aid is 27% of Palestine's GDP, which is now down to 1.8%. That's quite a large contribution, and of course the drop, that is very drastic. Anyways, let's find out what our guests think. That's more important. First segment of our Q&A, Rabia Billings Natuna joins us. She is a pro-Palestinian and human rights activist. Rabia Billings Natuna, welcome to Economic Divide. First question is about the occupation, both in Gaza and the OPT, Occupied Palestinian Territories. The economic consequences have been devastating, the Gaza Strip especially, things like water or controlling the material that comes in. How did that and the siege impact Gaza's economy, which in part was a driving factor perhaps behind what has occurred?
Okay, so my take is before we can delve into the economic factors, we have to realize that we can't look at the situation in a vacuum. We have to focus on, like, most resistance movements, like even in South Africa, starts with the basic denial of human rights. And what has happened in Gaza and the rest of Palestine is, and we've seen it, and the escalation of violence, which ultimately has seen 2023 as being the deadliest year for Palestinians. And it's everything. It's Israeli security forces who has perpetuated the widespread attacks on Palestinians, which also involved or included aerial bombardments. These aerial bombardments leave destruction on a massive scale. We've seen it this week as well. The Israeli military border police forces are killing Palestinian children. Palestinians are regularly subjected to violence by Israeli settlers, which includes things like physical attacks, shooting with live ammunition.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Let me bring in Blaine Coleman now. Blaine Coleman is a BDS activist and campaigner who joins us. Blaine Coleman, welcome to Economic Divide. In the occupied territories, in particular, obviously I'm talking about the West Bank here, there's a lot of Israeli control that it exerts over the Palestinian economic activity, with things like imports, workforce participation, for example, or the availability of Palestinian products on the market. We're trying to get an idea from you, if we can, the type of control and how much of it is exercised on the Palestinians, which makes life very hard for them.
Well, it's extraordinarily severe and cruel, this control that Israel exercises over the West Bank. For example, Israel has split the West Bank into hundreds of ghettos, sealed off from each other by hundreds of military checkpoints and roadblocks, supplemented by armed and dangerous settlers roaming the main roads. And so in the best of times, before this horrible assault on Gaza, life was like that in the West Bank. Now you've got these Israeli settlers driving Palestinians physically out of huge areas of the West Bank with a lot of violence. Now, the exact economic impact, if you want that, between 2000 and 2020, it has cost Palestinians $50 billion. $50 billion in the occupied West Bank is a lot of money.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for the in-depth section of the program. When it comes to the focus in this in-depth section, so many facts are unknown in terms of the way that Israel actually controls and restricts the Palestinian economy in more ways than one, and it has done so throughout the years and decades. And we'd like to give you a feel as to how Palestinian lives are therefore prevented from developing. So let's move on to the first item that we have for you. First is the 1994 Paris Protocol. Now, what's important about this, it shows the economic relation between Israel and Palestine. And this was an agreement between Israel, when it happened, and the PLO, signed on the 29th of April, 1994. And it was incorporated with minor amendments into, at that point, the Oslo II Accord of the same year. This protocol actually laid the groundwork, which basically strengthened the economic base, if you want to call it, of the Palestinian side, and for exercising its right of economic decision-making. Things like exports that are being absorbed by Israel, 85% of it is actually absorbed. Taxes, Israel has control of it. These are taxes that are supposed to pay the salaries of Palestinians. And in terms of competition, there are product restrictions, and then imports, let's say, from Israel, 70% of that is actually restricted. So this 1994 Paris Protocol should be termed Israel's restriction on the Palestinian economy. So a lot of problems emanate from this particular protocol that was signed. All right, let's move on to the next item that we have for you. This is also very important. It's the cost of checkpoints. There's so many checkpoints in the occupied territories. 60 million work hours are lost each year as a result of Palestinians forced to wait at the Israeli occupation checkpoints. Next up, $270 million, the annual cost to the economy resulting from the loss of work hours because of the checkpoints. When you spend time at the checkpoints, there's a loss of work as a result. Look at the amount of fuel. 80 million liters of fuel are wasted due to the time spent at checkpoints in traffic, for example, or to pass through the checkpoints as a result of building up congestion. Then we're looking at the cost for the gasoline itself, $135 million overall in petrol and diesel cost. Can you believe that checkpoints actually have these consequences for Palestinians? And then 196,000 tons of carbon dioxide is emitted per year. Well, that's on a climate-related note, which is a consequence, and of course that affects people's lives. So checkpoints is a big deal there in the occupied territories for the Palestinians when they want to, for example, go to work. We'll have that coming up in the Mahdi section. All right, let's move up to the next item, which is also very important here, and that's the losses that are incurred to the Palestinian economy. Now, I'm going to give you the population of Palestinians that exist there, which is estimated to be around 300,000 to 400,000 Palestinians who live in 532 residential areas You also have, of course, settlers there, 230 illegal settlements, but it covers 60% of the occupied West Bank. These are the losses that have been incurred. Some categories, general economic growth slowed down $1.1 billion. Dead Sea Minerals, $918 million. This is the type of loss that incurs on the Palestinian economy. $2,416.1 billion. I mean, that's a big loss when you think about how much this could enhance the lives of Palestinians. But as a result of these restrictions and